You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, the 13th. Oh, we ain't superstitious. No problem at all. I'm a good frame of mind. Got my stainless steel coffee thermos here, or my knockoff Yeti. I've had my two cherry Pop-Tarts. I'm good to go. So hopefully we'll settle in over the next couple of hours and finish this week off right. In the second hour, I'll be blessed to be joined by Tony Rossi. Tony Rossi, who's been a guest frequently before. He works for an organization called the Christophers, which is a Catholic organization really dedicating to highlighting examples of persons who didn't curse the darkness but chose to light a candle. And we'll be talking to Tony Rossi about an excellent piece he wrote honoring the late William Christopher, the actor who died at the end of this past year. A few shows ago, I talked about him playing, best known for playing Father Francis Mulcahy on the hit television show MASH, which if you're a child of the 70s and 80s, you cut your teeth on MASH. I can still remember going to a party for the MASH final episode, but Father Mulcahy, who played a Jesuit priest, chaplain, stationed there at the 4077 MASH. By the way, if you're really uninformed, MASH, Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. But anyway, so Francis Mulcahy, Tony Rossi argues that the Catholic Church and the Jesuits owe a great deal of gratitude and debt to William Christopher, who, by the way, was not Catholic himself. He was a Methodist, to which if I'd have ever met him, I'd have said, come on over, we former Methodists make good Catholics. Anyway, so we'll talk about that a little bit. We'll also talk a little bit more about Donald Trump and the press, and why in some ways I think we are in a situation where we are paying the price for the many years of an extremely biased press. And this is kind of what it's cost us, is the place that we're in today. And so we'll talk about this, some different analyses coming in of Donald Trump's first press conference in 6 months, and one I really appreciate from Tim Stanley, Tim, who was on the program just a few days ago in CNN. I'll tell you, there's no writer, no journalist, no observer of political science whose opinion and perspective I tend to appreciate more than Tim Stanley. I just think he has a way of looking at things very honestly. Kind of calls it as it is. And I thought he had an excellent piece in CNN about how really, no matter how you slice it, if this press conference was the next round in Donald Trump versus the press, Donald Trump won hands down, not even a split decision. So we'll talk about that and what the ramifications of that could be a little bit later in the show today. A couple of other things we want to talk about today. I actually talked about this when I had the opportunity to go down, or 2 days ago, I had the opportunity to go down to Asbury Seminary to share some about the Catholic faith with some evangelicals there. One of the things I talked to them about is that the church knows all about your aha. What I mean by that are those things, because I used to have them myself, and when you're not a Catholic, when you're a Christian, let's say a Protestant Christian, you think you've got these things, these aha points to disprove a Catholic on things, and what I kind of discovered along the way is the church kind of already knows about those ahas, and actually, shockingly, agrees with you. So we'll talk about that, and also Andrew Garfield, the actor's unexpected encounter, and a grieving father's haunting perspective. All that and more coming up on this Friday the 13th, We Spit in the Face of Superstition show. I'll certainly welcome your calls anytime. I'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4 is the number you can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. We'll also, of course, spin the Dalek Catechism wheel, look back in history, and make our What Were You Thinking nominations. The readings for today's Mass on this feast day of St. Hilary of, how do you say that in French? I know it's not Poitiers. Poitiers? I don't know. Great defender of the Trinity, one of those great saints. In a time the church was in great peril, of course, never in total peril because of Jesus' promise, the gates of hell and won't prevail and all that. But Hilary, St. Hilary, born, I think, in 315 A.D., so he was 10, I believe, when the Council of Nicaea was convened by Constantine to settle once and for all the dispute that had crept into the church about the identity and the nature of Jesus Christ. Was he, in fact, fully divine, or was he sort of divine-like? Was he co-eternal with the Father, or was he the Father's greatest creation, the supreme angel? And Arius, who was a priest who argued quite passionately, he was actually kind of the conservative in some ways, because he didn't want to go so far as to say that Christ was co-eternal and of the same substance with the Father. It's been often noted, by the way, that that whole council pivoted around one iota. The difference in the word homoousis, which means of the same substance, and homoiousis, which means of a similar substance. Of course, homoousis, consubstantial with the Father, we say it in the Creed every Sunday, won the day. But here's the thing, St. Hilary was 10 years old when that happened. And so it shows you that even though you settle a council, even though you take an issue and put it to rest, so you think, the enemy gets in and divides and scatters and all the rest. And so it continued to be a problem that had to be, the fruits of the council had to be tended to. And that's why people like St. Hilary, St. Athanasius, they were close friends. St. Hilary really had Athanasius back, and St. Hilary has sometimes been called the Athanasius of the West. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more. But just goes to show that you can have the truth, but not necessarily receive it. And it ties together actually kind of nicely with today's first reading from the letter to the Hebrews, because it's really a warning. It is a warning to these earliest Christians, and particularly Jewish Christians, which, by the way, is not an oxymoron. Sometimes we get that mistake in our mind. We think that when a person becomes a Christian, they cease being Jewish, and that's because we've sort of bought the false idea that intrinsic to Judaism is the rejection of Jesus. But if the earliest apostles were all Jewish, of course, that can't be true. In fact, what you would say is Judaism finds her consummation in Jesus Christ. And so you had these early Jewish Christians, Hebrews primarily written to them, and the warning of sorts being a warning that has been written into Scripture almost from the beginning. And that is that there is human freedom involved in the grace and mercy of God. In other words, you can have the truth. You can be the recipient of God's covenant love, but you can refuse to appropriate it. The gift can remain unopened. And this is what the author to the Hebrews says here in chapter 4, today's first reading. Let us be on our guard while the promise of entering into his rest remains, that none of you seem to have failed. For in fact, we have received the good news, just as our ancestors did. For the word that they heard did not profit them, for they were not united in faith with those who listened. And the analogy of sorts that the writer here is making is to the Hebrews, to the Jews, after their deliverance from Pharaoh's hand, as they were on the cusp of entering into the land of promise. If you'll recall, I think it's detailed in the book of Numbers, they send in the 12 spies to reconnoiter the land. They come back. 10 of the 12 spies say, look, it's too much. Walled cities, giant warriors, we can't do it. We're like grasshoppers. Only two, Joshua and Caleb, said, no, the Lord promised us this land. It's by his might, not our own. Let's go. Well, the majority report won the day. And as a result, as a consequence, this is where they wandered 40 years in the desert. And God said that none of those who disbelieved my promise, those who shrink back from what I'm laying before them, will die in the desert without entering into my rest. Only their children and Joshua and Caleb will survive to enter into the land of promise. And it's a warning. It's a in kind of a parable of sorts for us, that we can know the fullness of the faith in the church. We can know the glories of the Eucharist and the grace offered therein. We can know the mystery of a life hidden with Christ in God. And yet, if we allow our hearts to be hardened, yesterday's warning against that very thing from Psalm 95, if today you hear his voice, harden not your heart. We are free persons. This is why Catholics have never bought into the whole once saved, always saved. We have to endure to the end, trusting, leaning on the grace of God, but receiving it as a gift. We'll talk about this more in the second hour. Back with a question of the day on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. You are listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. I just talking to a guy last night, had the opportunity to go and speak in my full-time work with the Catholic Diocese to speak over the Cathedral of Christ the King and to speak to their RCIA class. By the way, that doesn't stand for Roman Catholic Intelligence Agency. That's more the realm of the albino assassin monks. RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults, and I was asked to go speak over there. Afterward, I was talking to a young man. He said, yeah, I was really looking forward to hearing you talk tonight because I used to love to listen to you on the radio, but then all of a sudden you just stopped being on the radio. I said, dude. Well, I didn't really say dude. I said, we're still around. We used to be here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from on AM and FM through an entity called Real Life Radio. I said, we're still around. All you got to do is stream us. Get the app for your smartphone, Breadbox Media. It's there. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you can announce it as we did time and time and time again, but we're all like that, right? We don't hear it. So, anyway, hope you're tuning in this morning. Joe, I think your name was Joseph. I've always loved that name, by the way. If I were to have an eighth child, which right now would be in the realm of the Zechariah and Elizabeth type miracle, maybe Joseph or Nathan, assuming it's a boy. 573-4-BREAD-4. My question of the day, I'm going to be talking to Tony Rossi of the Christophers at the bottom of the next hour. Tony, who's been on before, just one of these guys who finds, we sort of kvetch sometimes about how the news coverage we get is always bad. You know, if it bleeds, it leads, or scandal, corruption, partisan stuff. Tony Rossi and the Christophers are a refreshing alternative. People who say, I wish there was a news source just dedicated to good news. Well, the Christophers are like that, and he's going to be talking about William Christopher, the properly named, I guess you could say, given the context, the actor who played Father Francis Mulcahy in MASH. He passed away, I believe, at the age of 81 on the last day of 2016. And Tony Rossi arguing that the Catholic Church and the Jesuits owe a good bit to William Christopher for his very positive portrayal of a priest. So we'll talk about that in the second hour, but it then connects to my question of the day, which is, your favorite MASH episode of all time? I was a big MASH fan back in the day, and certainly have seen it plenty in syndication and in reruns. I have to admit, I have not watched as much MASH lately, so I had to be refreshed a little bit. By the way, if you want to chime in, you can call or text 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter, which some of you have done. I had to do a little refreshing of my memory on some of my favorite episodes. You know, you had cast changes over the years, of course. It was often remarked, you know, that what was a 2 or 3 year war maybe ended up being like a 9 or 10 year television series, but that's okay. I mean, you had the people who, like, Jamie Farr's character Klinger was there, Alan Alda, of course, Hawkeye Pierce through the duration, Loretta Swit, Father Mulcahy, one of those, I think, who made it through to the end. Then you had some changes, of course, Henry Blake replaced by Colonel Potter. I'm a Henry Blake fan myself, though certainly Potter not bad. Then you had Trapper John replaced by B.J. Honeycutt. And then you had Frank Burns replaced by Charles Emerson Winchester. Probably that it was that original group, Trapper John, Frank Burns, Colonel Blake, that in my opinion was the best, but that's just me. You may disagree. Anyway, so I went to a website that gave me 10 classic episodes of MASH. Maybe I'll mention them as we go along. One being Dear Dad, Season 1, Episode 12. This is when, you have, let me read it, remind myself about it again. Hawkeye was writing a letter home. You remember he was from Crabapple Cove, Maine. He was always talking about his father. It was a Christmas episode with Hawkeye writing a letter home, catching his father up on all the pre-holidays news from the camp. Some of the anecdotes are bizarre, like company clerk Radar O'Reilly shipping a Jeep back to his farm in Iowa, part by part. Some are more poignant, as when Hawkeye plays Santa for a group of Korean kids. MASH returned to this idea multiple times over the years, not just with Hawkeye, but with Colonel Potter, Dear Mildred, BJ, Dear Peggy, and so forth. So yeah, that's one I'll mention. But if you want to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. I think we've gotten a few responses on this already on Facebook. Ephraim says, Season 1, Episode 15, Tuttle. I'll have to look that one back up. Let's see, and Deacon Tony, he goes with the Dear Dad episode, Season 1, Episode 12. Anyway, yeah, great, great show. It became more, less slapstick comedy and more dramatic there toward the end. Particularly the last episode was heart-wrenching. It was a TV event. I remember it well. I still think one of the highest rated. I'll look that up. It's one of the highest rated single episodes in television history, from what I recall. So, sports-wise, of course, this weekend, the quarterfinals of the NFL, two playoff games in the AFC and two playoff games in the NFC. Let me see if I can make some predictions here. Saturday, tomorrow, you've got Seattle at Atlanta. I don't even know that that's going to be a game, I'll be honest with you. Unless Russell Wilson brings back some old glory from a couple of years ago. I mean, Atlanta, Matt Ryan. Listen, I understand the arguments for Tom Brady. I think Matt Ryan's the NFL MVP this year. Of course, it's not a bad thing to have Julio Jones to toss it to. But I think in the Georgia Dome, Atlanta's going to roll on that one. Houston at New England also. Saturday's not going to be the good games are Sunday. I'd be shocked if either Atlanta or New England lost Saturday. Sunday, you've got Pittsburgh at Kansas City. You've got the grizzled veteran Ben Roethlisberger, Pittsburgh, playoff weathered and tough. But I tell you what, the Chiefs are a heck of a team. I'm going to go with Kansas City on that one. And partly because I think I'm pulling for Andy Reid a little bit. Andy Reid, who, you know, in my opinion, you know, maybe it was good all the way around. But I thought he was treated fairly poorly in Philadelphia, to be honest. And he has shown since he left who got the better of that divorce. So I think Kansas City's going to win that game. And really the only road home upset I'm going to go with is I'm going to pick Green Bay to upset the Cowboys in Jerry World down there. I just think Aaron Rodgers is just willing the Packers to victory at this point. And Dak Prescott, rookie quarterback. What'll be interesting to see is if Dallas struggles at all on offense, will they go to Romo? Jerry Jones, is he going to make a phone call down to Jason Garrett and say, put Tony Romo in there? Which could have, I think, significant consequences for the offseason for Dallas. So we'll see. Dallas may prove me wrong, and they probably know that a lot of people are predicting them to potentially go down, and they're looking forward to proving folks wrong. But we'll see. If they blow out the Packers, then I guess I'll have egg on my face come Monday, but I'm a big boy. I can handle it. Checking out college basketball last night. Cincinnati with a big win over SMU at home. Cincinnati currently ranked. UCLA continues to look like a Final Four contender with a big win on the road against a pretty good Colorado team. And then Notre Dame winning at Miami. I don't think Mike Bray, I guess he'll have to go to a Final Four before he really gets credit. Still hard to believe Notre Dame basketball has not been to a Final Four since 1978. But if Mike Bray can get Notre Dame to a Final Four, he's got to start getting a little bit more credit. I mean, he's been at Notre Dame now a long time. Just year in and year out, he seems to have a solid, you know, not necessarily an elite team, but always a very solidly constructed, well-coached team. So college basketball, got to love it. Let's see if we can sneak in a What Were You Thinking nominee of the day. Got to love this one. Where is this from? This is from Toronto. So thankfully, it's not. No, I'm sorry. This is North Carolina, where not too far. Ajax, North Carolina, not too far from where my daughter lives. A 23-year-old driver has been charged with a slew of offenses after driving his car on only three wheels in Ajax on Wednesday. Police received five complaints regarding the rim-witted motorist who was driving with a missing front tire and rim. The vehicle was located as it three-wheeled out of a nearby fast food restaurant parking lot. So this guy was not, you know, like trying to just maybe get over to the side of the road or even get to the nearest gas station or garage. He was just tooling around the town with three wheels on his car and one missing. Of course, it was scratching the pavement everywhere he went. This young man, Camden Johnson Holder, he also, believe it or not, was seized with a small quantity of marijuana and a bong. I don't care how stoned you are, seriously. If you can't tell you're driving on three wheels, what are you thinking, man? We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
right, at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to become a friend of your favorite show? Go to breadboxmedia.com, click on the Friend of the Show link. You can also, while you're there, learn more about what we do. You can do us a big favor. Just spread the word about Breadbox Media. You know, tell people that you've discovered this resource and you appreciate the programming, and they should check it out, whether they listen live through the stream with the app for their digital device or whether they listen to the podcast. Always a great option. Podcasts very popular today. All of our shows, not long after they air live, go up on podcast, and you can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Again, my question of the day, what is your favorite MASH episode of all time? We'll be talking with Tony Rossi of the Christophers a little bit later in the program about the debt of gratitude that the Catholic Church and the Jesuits owe to the late William Christopher, the actor who passed away on the last day of 2016, known for playing Father Francis Mulcahy on the show. Of course, when you talk about the greatest MASH episodes of all time, I think any list has to include Abyssinia Henry, Season 3, Episode 24, the last episode with McLean Stevenson, a.k.a. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake. As this description in the website avclub.com says, a top-to-bottom stunner of an episode. This third season finale shows what happens when Henry Blake gets his discharge papers and has to wind down his business at the 407 7th in preparation for the trip home. Of course, it's full of practical details about packing up and leaving and has some of their best scenes in MASH regarding drunken revelry. But then comes the gut punch. Of course, the whole goodbye scene where he kisses Hot Lips Houlihan, where he greets Klinger in a dress with some kind of a fruit wrap around his hair. I don't know, you know, Klinger always angling for that Section 8 psychological discharge by dressing in women's clothing. Little did he know it, that wouldn't be a problem in the military a few decades later. Anyway, in a scene that was added without the cast's advanced knowledge at the end, Radar comes into the operating room to tell the doctors and nurses that Henry's plane back to the States was shot down. The actors didn't know this was coming. I think that's what a great idea from the director, Gelbart. He directed the episode himself, and after Radar's announcement, the camera pans slowly across the room, getting real reactions from the genuinely stunned actors. It's a signature moment of both MASH and 70s TV as a whole. No doubt. So chime in if you want. Okay, back to our What Were You Thinking nominees. Go dumb or go home, as we like to say. We have an article here about hilarious tattoo fails. This from London's Daily Mail. Hilarious tattoo fails show how things go badly wrong when the inker can't spell. That'd be, you know, there's a lot of things when you're going to a tattoo artist that you want to vet before you let them put ink to your skin. One, you may want to see if they can print out their transcript from school, because if they can't spell, then you're got a mess on your hands. So they have pictures of some of the worst fails in tattoo history. Only God can fudge me. Another one that says, you see printed on a woman's arm, here in my heart, but heart is spelled H-A-E-R-T. Another one's on someone's bicep. Never don't give up. Oh, the double negative. How about a woman across her back? Stay strong no matter what happens. Instead of W-H-A-T, it's W-A-T-H. And finally, one that says, my mom is my angle. Not angel, so that's our second nominee. But the winner we're going to give to the guy on social media. Let the music resound. Let the people rejoice. There was much rejoicing. Yay! This guy on the internet, on social media, I guess it's on Facebook, rejoicing, including a link in his post, rejoicing over the vote by the Senate to repeal Obamacare. He writes, one step closer to fixing this mistake, and only a couple weeks left of Barry's regime. 2017 is already looking up. But then in the thread below his text, or below his status update and the link to the article, it becomes apparent that the guy himself is on Obamacare. Somebody posted and said, really cool of you to treat those of us who need the assistance provided by the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, with such disregard, so forth and so forth. And the guy who posted the original piece says, where to start? First, we're talking about Obamacare, not the ACA. He goes on to say that, hey, I'm not on Obamacare. I'm on the ACA, until someone points out to him, dude, the Obamacare is the ACA. That's just the sort of catchy slang that the Republicans came up with to connect it with the president. Oops. So make sure you're informed before you start ripping on Obamacare. Make sure you're informed enough to know whether or not you're on it. Oh, my goodness. The internet is unforgiving, too, because you can scrub, you can delete all you want, but somebody will do the old screen captcha, and it's there forever. Anyway, we're always open to your own nominations. If you want to shoot me one, you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or shoot me a call or text, 573-4BREAD-4. Yesterday we talked a little bit about President-elect Trump, the POTUS, his press conference that he had. We're now, 1 week away from his inauguration, peaceful transition of power. That should be something else. The inauguration is going to be fantastic. It's going to be tremendous. It's going to be great. Have no doubt. It was a very combative press conference, of course, that he had, but it was also sort of strange because, you know, you had this whole situation where BuzzFeed chose to print what amounted to, I guess, fake news, unsubstantiated, scandalous sort of stories about Donald Trump. You had some other networks that, like CNN, that Trump just does not like and lumped in there with a group like BuzzFeed. And then you had others that he affirmed. It was like you were either on the ins with the Donald or you were on the outs with the Donald. It was an odd sort of dynamic that was going on. But I was interested in analyses that could maybe rise above just pure partisanship, because, you know, we don't do that very well. So I thought it was interesting in The Atlantic, which, as I've said before, I think among the type of publications that it is, which is a sort of, you know, left-leaning secular publication. But when you compare it to something like Slate or Salon, I think The Atlantic much more balanced and even-handed in the way that it treats different issues. And this piece in The Atlantic says, Trump manhandles the media. Trump took full advantage of a weakened and divided press corps in his first news conference as president-elect. As he writes here, Donald Trump's first press conference was still hours away, but the scene at Trump Tower was already turning hostile. Hundreds of journalists had crammed into the too small atrium Wednesday morning, and many were grumpily jockeying for position and power outlet access. Quaffed TV correspondents elbowed notebook-toting scribblers out of their live shots. Producers grumbled about CNN unjustly colonizing a swath of prime seating up front. Camera operators barking at each other on the risers. The atmosphere at Trump's press events often has a zoo-like quality. At this one, it felt like the animals had been starved, hunted, and turned against each other. Indeed, he says, the press corps Trump faced Wednesday seemed more divided and less sure of itself than the one that grilled him 6 months ago when he last held a formal press conference. And with his surprise victory last November, Coppins writes, he didn't just beat and embarrass his foes in the political press. He burned down their villages, defiled their temples, and danced on the graves of their dead. In the months that followed, news outlets entered into prolonged periods of soul-searching and self-flagellation while Trump took victory laps. Some of the same reporters and pundits who once laughed off his chances were reduced to aggregating his tweets, pleading for access, and posing for chummy group photos at Mar-a-Lago. At the dawn of the Trump presidency, he writes, America's political press corps is feeling anxious, territorial, threatened, and the president-elect showed Wednesday he's ready to take advantage. Again, this is coming from a left-leaning outlet that's saying, look, if you want to see this first press conference as the latest round in the Trump versus the press, then this was in no contest. The referee stopped in to prevent any further beating from the shaken opponent. We'll talk about this a little bit more on the other side of the break. Tim Stanley's perspective on it, which he writes in CNN. And I think it highlights what's brought us to this point and why, I don't know, it could be, we could be getting ready to enter into some sort of dangerous time in many ways. And in some ways, the press has no one to blame but themselves. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hour. You are back on the Mike Allen Show. Let's look back in history on this day over the ages, January 13th, over the decades. I'll find some interesting things. Here we go. 1559, Elizabeth I crowned Queen of England in Westminster Abbey, succeeding her half-sister, Mary, the Catholic Mary. Not a good day for Catholics, by the way. 1864, on this day, Stephen Foster dies at the age of 37 in New York. Composer, of course, of My Old Kentucky Home, Camptown Ladies, and the rest. 1929, Wyatt Earp died on this day, the sheriff of Tombstone. I'm forgetting the name of it. All right. Let's see, 1957, Wham-O produces the first Frisbee. 60 years old is the Frisbee today, hard to believe. 1961, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, her birthday, she's 56 years old today. Part of that absolutely genius ensemble. Marshall, that's what Wyatt Earp was, sorry. I knew it'd pop in my mind eventually. 1964, 53 years ago today, Karol Wojtyła, who would later be known, of course, as Pope John Paul II and then Pope St. John Paul II, appointed Archbishop of Krakow by Pope Paul VI. McDreamy, 51 years old today, Patrick Dempsey. We've got a house full of daughters who are Grey's Anatomy fans. They'd be interested in that. It was on this day in 1968 that country music legend Johnny Cash recorded his live concert at Folsom Prison. Happy 40th to Orlando Bloom and a 39th to Nate Silver, founder of one of my favorite websites, 538.com. 1982, Hank Aaron and Frank Robinson both elected to the Hall of Fame. Talk about your no-brainer votes. And in 1989, Bernie Getz sentenced to 1 year in prison, the New York City subway gunman vigilante, for possessing an unlicensed gun that he used to shoot four youths he said were about to rob him. Became sort of the one of the first culturally dividing inkblot tests, Bernie Getz, what you thought about him. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, if you want to chime in. Again, asking a question today, we'll be talking to Tony Rossi about William Christopher, the actor, and why he, in particular, had such an impact in terms of a positive portrayal of the Catholic faith as a Jesuit priest chaplain stationed at the 4077. So we're asking, what's your favorite MASH episode of all time? You can post a link on or post your answer on Facebook or on Twitter, social media, or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Anyway, we were talking about Donald Trump and his press conference, the combative nature of it, and how, even from the perspective of the Atlantic, McKay Coppins, Donald Trump basically beat down the press, or in his words, manhandles the media. He took full advantage of a weakened and divided press corps. Tim Stanley, our guest from a couple days ago, writes for the London Daily Telegraph, but contributes occasionally to CNN, who was on the receiving end of Donald Trump's wrath at the press conference. Tim Stanley writing this column in CNN that says, how did President-elect Trump handle his press conference? He nailed it. He said it was strange, abusive, occasionally misleading, but he nailed it, Stanley says. And while the media will complain that he tried to silence individual reporters, which he did, the reality is that the conference was about as raw and detailed as you're likely to get from a president-elect. He said he gave us a dozen headlines from just one press conference. And then I thought this may be the money line of the whole piece from Tim Stanley. He said, this is the Trump paradox. Trump and the press hate each other, yet they feed off each other. We actually learned a lot, Stanley says. Trump's two legislative priorities are building the wall and repealing and replacing Obamacare. By the way, just as an aside to my many pro-life friends who voted for Donald Trump as the great pro-life hope, you will notice we have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president-elect. How much talk have you heard about abortion? Seriously, is it listed anywhere on Trump's priorities? We'll see 4 years from now, won't we? We'll see. Hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid once again we've been played. Anyway, well, he goes on to talk. Tim Stanley says, of course, he compared the behavior of some within the intelligence community to Nazis, suggested that at the very mention of Senator Lindsey Graham makes him laugh. He even pledged to sack his sons, Stanley writes, should they underperform while running his businesses. And perhaps most importantly of all, he signaled that no amount of speculation on his relationship with Vladimir Putin will shift his positions towards Russia. Yes, they were probably guilty of hacking, but that will change once Trump is in charge. He goes on to talk about Trump's behavior. He said, for some unclear reason, he has decided that CNN, which did not publish the allegations that were in BuzzFeed, that it could not independently verify, Trump accused them of trying to undermine him, and he shouted down questions from CNN's Jim Acosta. He said it was unfair, bullying behavior. But calling out the press is not entirely unheard of. I mean, if you think about it, right, President Obama called out Fox News on a regular basis. Richard Nixon obsessed about the hostile liberal press. What's different about Trump is how happy he is to personalize his battles, Stanley writes, to roll up his sleeves and jump into the fight while on live TV. He says, and Stanley says, while this is, yes, unpresidential, it's probably not unpopular. He says the media has to accept that popular attitudes toward journalism have shifted according to partisan bias, and there are a lot of conservatives nowadays who disbelieve unfavorable reporting of Trump simply because they don't trust its source. In their opinion, Stanley writes, conservatives have been losing since George W. Bush because they've been too nice, and Trump's aggressive approach is not only entertaining, but necessary. Stanley goes on to say that it's noticeable that whenever Trump hasn't gotten an answer for a difficult question, he'll say, when he doesn't have an answer for a difficult question, he'll say the public doesn't care about it. He said, on everything from his business contacts in Russia to his taxes, he's probably correct enough about this assessment to get away with the deflection. In other words, I could see this style of press conference getting him out of trouble more than it lands him in it. So, here's the thing, as I think about this weakened state that the press is in, this weakened position, is largely due to the fact that much of the press, let's be honest, has been a handmaid of the Democratic Party for however long. And therefore, confidence in the press, particularly across the heartland of this country, in all those red zones that you saw on electoral maps, confidence in the press may be at an all-time low. Of course, it's only exacerbated by the proliferation of all kind of news sources on the internet and fake news and all the rest. But the press was so, in many ways, unbalanced, let's just say, has been unbalanced in its coverage of the right and the left. It's in many ways fawning coverage, which continues in the waning days of his presidency. Fawning coverage of Barack Obama, a refusal to hold him to account for things that he did that were constitutionally suspect. The expansion of executive power, for example, the going after groups like the Little Sisters of the Poor. He was treated largely with kid gloves. And therefore lost, I think, a great deal of their credibility at doing really what journalism is intended to do, and that is to be truth tellers in the midst of a political world in which it's much easier to simply give the public misinformation, propaganda, and the rest. And so we've come to a place now where, by and large, people don't trust the media. They question their motives. And because the guy that they didn't want to win desperately has won, they find themselves in a position of just trying to get access. And they find themselves in a very weak position. And Donald Trump does not have, I don't think, he's not going to be one who is not going to take full advantage. He's going to be ruthless in this. And as Tim Stanley says, this is a huge stylistic contrast from Obama. He said, on Tuesday night, Obama rounded off his presidency with a typically professorial speech that told us what we've been all getting wrong and what we need to do to make things better. A moral lecture, in other words. Trump, by contrast, Stanley says, just gets down to business. It's frequently disingenuous and often ugly, but it's compelling. Anyway, I'll put a link to this on the show's Facebook page. We'll be back with a new hour. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.